From KPFK Pacifica Radio, this is Rising Up with Sonali, and I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. You can watch this program on Free Speech TV and listen to it on Pacifica Radio stations and affiliates nationwide. When 17-year-old Kyle Rittenhouse shot numerous protesters active with Black Lives Matter in Kenosha, Wisconsin, he tried to turn himself in to police. After all, he was illegally armed and had just killed two people and injured one. But police ignored him. In fact, earlier that day, police told the armed right-wing vigilantes that Rittenhouse was a part of, quote, "We appreciate you guys, we really do." There is a long history of American police officers working hand-in-hand with hate groups, white supremacist and white nationalist movements in the United States. Making those links in a new report called Hidden in Plain Sight is my guest, Michael German. Michael is a fellow with the Brennan Center for Justice's Liberty and National Security Program. He's a former FBI special agent, and he wrote a book called Disrupt, Discredit, and Divide, How the New FBI Damages Democracy. He now joins me to discuss his new report for the Brennan Center. The full title is Hidden in Plain Sight, Racism, White Supremacy, and Far-Right Militancy in Law Enforcement. Welcome to the program, Michael.
Thanks for having me.
So the history of these links is quite deep. Let's start there. I know it goes even further back than 1964, but in your report, right, you point out one particular incident to highlight these links between hate groups and police, and that was the killings of three men, Andrew Goodman, James Cheney, and Schwerner, whose first name I can't remember
Michael,
now.
I believe.
Michael Schwerner. Tell me about this incident and why it belongs in your report.
So I think that was the incident that galvanized the nation that there was a problem with white supremacist organizations working hand in glove with law enforcement, where it was very clear that these three young men were set up for their assassinations by law enforcement. Law enforcement had arrested them, put them in jail, contacted Ku Klux Klan members, and let them know when and where they were going to be released, so that they could be interdicted and killed. And I think that was really a galvanizing moment during the civil rights movement where number one, it forced the FBI to finally start taking the problem seriously. And they sent hundreds of agents down to Mississippi to address white supremacist violence. And you know, as you said, this wasn't a new problem, and it wasn't a problem localized to the South. But sometimes it takes some horrible incident to bring it to the public's realization. And since then, it's not gone away. It still remains a problem. And you know, I know from when I was a young FBI agent, and I was asked to work undercover in neo-Nazi groups, it was something that was discussed. We were working with a joint terrorism task force, which included other law enforcement agencies, and we had to make sure that everyone understood that this needed to be kept quiet, because there were people in law enforcement who had sympathy for these groups. That was a warning that went out regularly within the FBI, warning its own agents and partner law enforcement agencies working on domestic terrorism, that some of the subjects of your domestic terrorism cases against white supremacists and far-right militants have contacts in law enforcement. And these reports have been leaked. One came out in 2006, another in 2015, that document this internal warning. And yet there is no national strategy to identify these white supremacist police officers or to make sure that they aren't harming the public.
Just to go back to the history part of it, you do write in your book that slave patrols were among the first public policing organizations formed in the American colonies, and it seems as though there is this direct line historically. Well, let's talk more about this, what the FBI has known about police departments. For years, we've heard that, you know, it's implicit bias that drives, police overreactions to suspects who are people of color that causes them to be overzealous in shooting their guns. And so there's all sorts of training. And the implication is that, well, of course, police are going to have implicit biases because there is implicit bias in all of us. It's a societal problem. Naturally, it's going to be something that's present in police as well. We can't expect police to be completely free of the disease that infects society. But it's not just implicit bias, you write. There's explicit bias in police departments. How well documented is that by the FBI?
So the warnings are documented. You know, unfortunately, even with white supremacist violence not involving the police, the FBI deprioritizes that work. So today, the FBI can't tell you how many people white supremacists killed in the United States last year, or the year before that, or 10 years before that. They don't keep that data. They don't investigate those cases on a regular basis. So there's a lack of data from which to draw any kind of analysis, and particularly with these warnings about law enforcement involvement, these are officers who people in the police departments know about their racist activities, but they don't do anything about it unless it bubbles up to public attention. And then often there's public outrage, and then the police will leadership will take action, or the city council will take action. But in the meantime, these officers are patrolling the streets with weapons. And we know from data that is collected about police activity that there are racial disparities in every step of the criminal justice process, from who gets stopped and searched, to who gets arrested, to how they get charged, to how long they're sentenced, to use of force issues, which again are timely right now with the questions that people are having across the country about police violence. So this structural racism does exist, and there is some merit to the argument that part of this is that our society is still infected with white supremacy in a lot of different aspects. Our nation was founded as a white supremacist project by European colonists. And the laws that law enforcement was enforcing up until the Civil Rights Act were openly white supremacist laws. So there's obviously some infection still in our society and in various elements of our society. So we shouldn't be surprised that it's also involved in police. But because police are the enforcement arm of the law, it often has a more direct and drastic effect on the lives and liberty of many Americans from communities of color or other classes that are targeted by these ideologies.
So there's the issue of law enforcement sort of going easy on hate groups. We see their tolerance of armed militias, you know, these armed white men with Confederate flags that don't seem to elicit much reaction from police, but unarmed protesters who might, you know, damage a building, get disproportionate attention. So you see this sort of tolerance, but then there's also instances where police are actively members of law enforcement related gangs, or even overtly members of hate, documented hate groups like the KKK. So we see these in headlines and local papers, but it's not clear, you were saying, that it's being documented nationwide to see the full trend.
Right. Yeah. There's the Justice Department and the FBI, while they warn their agents to protect their cases from a white supremacist sympathizer within law enforcement who might use the terrorist watch list as an example to try to find out if they or their friends are under investigation. It warns agents about that, but it doesn't say anything about how to protect the community. The FBI, in addition to being responsible for counterterrorism, is also responsible for protecting our civil rights. And there should be a national strategy that is designed to identify these officers and make sure they are not put in a position where they can harm communities that they police. And this is something that's been long overdue. As you mentioned earlier, often when we talk about these racial disparities in the criminal justice system, it gets framed as a product of unconscious bias, structural bias, implicit bias. But if we don't acknowledge that there's also explicit bias, I don't think unconscious bias training can be very successful in resolving the problem. And unfortunately, we haven't seen a national effort, and really very few regional or state or local efforts as well. You know, they'll identify a problem once the public finds out about it and deal with it, but there's no systematic approach to this increasingly dangerous element within law enforcement.
We do know that what's termed right-wing violence or right-wing hate groups, vigilantes, are responsible for a significant number of killings in the United States, especially compared to the so-called Antifa or anti-fascist left-leaning groups. But police are not counted in those, are they, in that examination?
Certainly police killings are not where police actually kill somebody or harm somebody. But you know what some groups do count is some advocacy groups count the number of police officers killed by far-right militants. And that's something that is confounding for me as a former law enforcement officer who knew that police knew that back in the 90s. You know, you have to remember the Oklahoma City attack was an attack on federal law enforcement.
Right, because there's this sort of conservatism that both is pro-police but anti-government, and police being extensions of the government are sometimes seen by some factions of the extreme right as part of the problem. So there's a little bit of a contradiction there at work.
Well, I think what there is a lot of disinformation, right? Mm. These groups like to present themselves as to try to appeal to certain communities. And it's easy to slap a Blue Lives Matter patch on your uniform. But what we see time and time again, when they violate the law and police try to take action, the police become the target. And it's a very dangerous game these law enforcement agencies are playing by fraternizing with these groups and by allowing them to engage in public violence and walk away without any penalty, because these groups are now attracting much more violent people who realize that, oh, I want to commit violence, I can go to this rally, and as long as I dress like these far-right militants, I'm allowed to do it and walk away. And eventually they will. And, you know, when you look at since the George Floyd protests started, the only instances where police were specifically targeted and assassinated, it was far right militants, not so-called Antifa or anarchists or protesters. These are people who specifically went out to kill law enforcement officers. And I think law enforcement is making a mistake if they think these people are actually their friends.
Is there something about, I mean, I don't know if you've covered this in your report, but is there something about the kind of ideology that our police departments in America today attract? You know, is it that people get radicalized and attracted to hate once they're in the police, or that the profession itself attracts a certain kind of person enamored of the idea of being armed and wielding power?
I think it's all of the above. I don't believe in this radicalization theory. I think violent people are attracted to groups that promote their violence. And, you know, certainly there are people who are attracted to law enforcement because it allows them to bully other people. Naturally, I don't think that is the majority of them, but unfortunately, there seems to be comfort with them being in the ranks and not being forced out that needs to change. A lot of it is the polarization of our society. We used to be able to have disagreements in a civil manner and issue by issue, where it seems like nowadays everybody's on one side or the other, and you have to be completely uniform in all of the issues to be a fully participating part of that side. And the police tend to find their side, or find by their side in these sorts of debates, these same far-right militants. And obviously under the Trump administration, the government has become much more openly embracing of these far-right groups, which again creates bigger problems, because now They're focused on a common enemy of anti-fascists, and it might create some room where police think, because they're both targeting the same groups, that somehow these groups are friendly with the police. But that won't last very long as soon as police start enforcing the law.
And of course, we have Trump, a president who has not only very openly signaled to white supremacists that he is their president, but also to police that he is their president. He's made it very clear that he will protect police. He doesn't want police to be held accountable for any killings. He's been very clear where he stands on both of these groupings of people that overlap.
Right. And you know, this is a very old playbook, right? This is the authoritarian playbook that would-be dictators have used all over the world. The idea that you authorize an auxiliary force of thugs to go after your political enemies, and they work hand in hand with the official police up until those communities start engaging in some kind of protective self-defense, because the police aren't defending them, and then you have open combat on the street, and then the masses of the public demand some sort of order, so the dictator can say, fine, I will create order now by suppressing these far-right militants. But then half of them who become part of the official police, and the other half become criminals and are arrested as part of the sacrifice. But in that attempt to arrest them, they'll become far more violent towards the police attempting to force the law. But the idea is that the authoritarian wants to gain more power as a result of the civil unrest that he or she is unleashing on society to get that power.
You write in your report that it isn't just police departments. There's also federal law enforcement, such as Border Patrol agencies. And it's been documented that for years that Border Patrol agencies end up working in tandem, or, you know, in a way that tolerates or signals to some of the armed right-wing anti-immigrant vigilante groups that gather at the border. So tell me about that aspect of this, because, of course, these are federal law enforcement.
Sure. I mean, it was interesting following the way media and some of the counterterrorism commenters would talk about far-right militancy as if it somehow disappeared during the Bush administration, when in fact there was quite a bit of border militia activity, and that was at the same time a lot of the anti-immigrant rhetoric was heating up, and we saw a lot of militant activity that was not being policed, and some of it was violent. And you know, there are any number of homicides involved. But also, you know, there's a lot of violence that migrants suffer that never gets investigated or solved, right? There's just an assumption that, well, you know, that might have been some drug courier that was killed, or it might be human traffickers who killed them, and no real investigation, when we have these armed militant groups going out professing that they're there to engage in vigilante activities. So, you know, unfortunately, that I think was another one of these elements where law enforcement felt too comfortable with these groups, and that they were somehow on the same side of the issue.
So finally, Michael, given that the federal government is not interested in addressing this issue, what would you advise to local police departments who say they don't want these sorts of elements in their department? They want to reject the infiltration of their departments by folks involved in groups like the KKK or other, you know, any number of white supremacist organizations. Are there ways in which they can, one, I imagine, should be disqualified from joining a police department if one is found to be linked to a hate group or making hateful, racist, misogynist comments on social media, et cetera.
Right. And you know, there are easy cases where somebody joins the Ku Klux Klan that has a 100-year history of criminal violence. But you know, there are other cases that are a little harder to navigate. So I understand why that's difficult for law enforcement leaders to address. But what they need to do is not wait for a crisis, not wait until the public somehow find out about some racist organization within the police department or affiliation with an outside racist group, that they should go ahead and draw up and strengthen their anti-racism policies that are vetted through corporate council, city councilors, to make sure that they have strong policies that are communicated directly with the officers, so the officers have awareness of where the bright line rules are. So if they violate them, it's much easier to go through the disciplinary process without a lot of litigation. But most of all, I think what could be very effective, and this was an idea that I first read about by Georgetown professor Vida B. Johnson, prosecutors use police officers in cases every day, and they have a legal obligation to provide exculpating evidence to the defendants, right? So if we know that an officer is involved with a racist group or is engaged in racist behavior, that's information the defendant needs to be aware of, so we can empower our adversarial system to work properly and challenge the testimony that officer brings into court. So because of this obligation, prosecutor's office keep what is called a Brady list, Brady being the Supreme Court rule that exculpating information in the possession of the prosecutor needs to be turned over to the defense. And Professor Johnson makes the arguments that racist officers should be on these lists, and those that have engaged in improper behavior should be revealed to the defense. And that would go a long way towards helping these police leaders, because if you have a police officer you know cannot testify in court, you're not going to assign that officer to where they're interacting in law enforcement functions with the public. Mm-hmm. There are plenty of police jobs that don't involve interaction with the public. Those people can remain on the job if they haven't engaged in some conduct worthy of termination. But the public still needs to be protected from them. And the police department has to create a mitigating strategy to make sure that the public is protected.
And of course, a very simple thing that police departments could do to tackle the issue of hate in their ranks is to fire officers that are, you know, that kill unarmed people and hold them accountable, support any charges against them, et cetera. That would be a basic thing as well.
and it's just important to know, you know, we don't want to empower police agencies to do ideological screening, because I don't think that they would be very good at that. And I think that, you know, they would look at somebody like me, who used to be with the ACLU, as ideologically unfit for law enforcement. So, you know, we have to be careful and make sure that we are, you know, these police officers do deserve due process just like everyone else. But if we have strong policies that have been vetted for their constitutionality and for their compliance with whatever employee contracts exist, it's much easier to fire them when they break those rules. And so that's why it's important to get those policies straightened out before there's a crisis.
Well, Michael, I want to thank you so much for joining us today. We'll post a link to the report you authored from our website and give out the website for the Brennan Center as well, where people can just find the report themselves.
Sure, brennancenter.org.
That's brennancenter.org. Thanks so much, Michael.
Okay, thank you.
My guest has been Michael German. He's a fellow with the Brennan Center for Justice's Liberty and National Security Program. We've been talking about the new report he authored, Hidden in Plain Sight, Racism, White Supremacy, and Far-Right Militancy in Law Enforcement. He's a former FBI special agent and wrote a book called Disrupt, Discredit, and Divide, How the New FBI Damages Democracy. I'm Sonali Kolhatkar, online at risingupatsonali.com, where you can sign up for our daily newsletter. Also follow us on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram at RU with Sonali.